It's a pleasure to be here. I'm really enjoying this unusually diverse and very interesting conference. I want to thank the organizers for organizing a wonderful conference and inviting me, giving me this opportunity. So I want to talk about machine learning, quantum emergence from complex data. And these are two different types of data that I'll be talking about. But I want to first step back and think about what I mean by learning quantum emergence. As a condensed matter theorist studying quantum materials, quantum systems, what we want to be able to do is to go from some complex reality to some simple concepts. And in particular, we want to be able to target interesting properties, interesting phenomena, such as topological states or high-TC superconductivity. But what we are trying to organize and have exhibit certain behavior are trillion of individual electrons, 10 to the 23, you know, translated into lay people friendly term is trillion. So what do I think is learning? For me, learning is about going from complex reality of data that could be some tunneling density of state measured as a function of position, voltage, temperature, doping, et cetera, tuning parameters, scattering amplitude measured as a function of reciprocal space position, moment, i.e. momentum, temperature, pressure, magnetic field, et cetera, tuning parameters, or many-body wave functions or many-body states that we use to simulate. And we feel, I feel satisfied, I feel empowered when I can compress the knowledge of this data into something simple, something that is informative, such as a measure of symmetry breaking or topological invariant. And these are, once you have compressed this knowledge into some measures like this, those are universal, simple quantities that you can remember. What is happening going from this data to these properties is what we call emergence, is in a way there are functions, and oftentimes we know how to write the function. So if you know how to write the function going from the reality of data to some simple principles that we can discuss on a piece of paper, and we can go back from the simple principle back to the complex reality, this is regression, and this is kind of generation. And this whole process that gives us great joy becomes very challenging when we try to deal with quantum many-body systems. So now facing this challenge and recognizing there is kind of data science view to this aspect of it, that is, there's a regression and there's generative modeling. Can we make use of the developments in machine learning and data science tools to make further progress is the goal. So what are data-driven challenges in quantum condensed matter problems? We've heard a lot of discussions of many-body states, how complex they are, the many-body wave functions or many-body states that we try to simulate with. But there's also measurements in real space. The tunneling density of states measured in 1962 through a macroscopic tunnel junction separating two superconductors, this would be an insulating barrier, you get conductance as a function of the bias voltage showing these kind of features, and we understand every aspect of this curve. We understand why there's a suppression, that's the gap. We understand why there's a peak, that's a coherence peak. Not only those salient features, we also understand these little wiggles. And understanding of those wiggles actually gave us confidence we know what is going on with BCS superconductivity. Understanding of those wiggles are well represented in this famous paper. And what these authors did was to be able to plot what one would expect based on some sophisticated theory involving diagrammatics and principled approximations. Nowadays, I want to look at this as a very successful generative model. This is a generative model that was guided by the domain knowledge of a theoretical physicist. But what if this generative model does not work? This is a wonderful model with wonderful history, deep theory underneath it. That's all great. But what if it doesn't work? What do we do then? Fast forward to 2000s, now we don't measure tunneling density of states as a single curve for the entire sample, but instead we measure it with atomic resolution. There is vacuum playing the role of tunnel barrier, and you measure this tunneling conductance as a function of position with subatomic resolution. And what results out of that is this kind of much more complex data. Now I have those curves at each of these positions, at each of the pixel positions. So because of those energy dependence curve, I have this kind of three-layered cake data. How do I approach this data when I don't have as successful a generative model as the Scalapino and collaborators model? Moving to the momentum space, comprehensive data with modern detectors, the detector technology have evolved. It evolved well past, it evolved from pre-Stone Age, prehistoric era, to, you know, through Stone Age to the modern age. Now we have comprehensive 2D detectors that are generating, that can detect data at, you know, gigabytes, hundreds of gigabytes per hour, reaching terabytes. So this is an example of such data set showing 3 by 3 by 3 cubes of Brillouin zone. And what's shown here are intensities. This is distribution of intensities at different points in momentum space. And the current state of art in detector technology have evolved, but the state of art in analyzing this data have not evolved. So how can we meet these challenges with the new tools is what I want to talk about. In looking at the reciprocal space, there's large volume of data, but the problem is what you're interested in. Often, this is a problem with large complex sets of data. Probably what you're interested in are some sparse rare regions that are buried in the large background. In this case of X-ray data, there is low intensity background that's just a plain noise, and there's high intensity quote unquote background, which is for just reflecting the atomic structure if that's not what we are interested in. If what we are interested in is emergent collective phenomena of electrons, we don't care about knowing the position of atoms. If it's a crystal, we already know the position of atoms. There are different types of background that's taking up the large volume, and what you're after is a needle in the haystack, and it's not a single needle in a single haystack, but you have these haystacks as a function of temperature, pressure, doping, etc., other tuning parameters. Our experimentalists have wonderful ability to tune. So how do we search for this beyond the current state of manual approach, lifting one hay string at a time? Now, there was a talk about Stone Age versus Golden Age, and I want to give you a disclaimer that everything that I'm going to talk about today is in a way using Stone Age tools. So this is Mortel and Pestle, Stone Age tools. It looks like it just came out of some archaeological site. However, if you want to make guacamole, these are the best. They actually crush as opposed to cut. And so, you know, if you have the right kind of task, what I have is a bunch of ripe avocados hanging low down on the tree, what I want to pull out is these Stone Age tools. And the fact that this has 4.5 stars sold at the whopping, you know, $50 US dollars is a proof that I'm not the only one who believes in this Stone Age tools. So all the tools that I'm going to use, looking at either synthetic data or STM data, are going to be very, very shallow, extremely shallow neural networks, maybe even pre-Stone Age, pre-human. What I'm going to be using, looking at the X-ray data generating modeling, is almost Stone Age, you know, around 2013-ish tools. But we're finding great use in them, and they are efficient, like the, you know, the tool for avocados. So supervised machine learning and synthetic data, I don't want to dwell on this too long, but I just want to give a flavor of where we are to the experts in the audience. You'll recognize some of familiar faces here. We've been working on making great progress in using neural networks to learn turn numbers and Wilson loops, recognizing topological phases. And all of this effort was really spearheaded by Frank E. Zhang, who used to be, who was a postdoctoral fellow at Cornell, now recently started his group at Peking University. He's around here. Roger, we had fun working with Roger. My current student, Mike Meddy, is carrying on the effort. And you see another familiar person here who, in this picture, he's not only young in spirit, but also young, you know, physically. That's Paul. And we've been also working on learning transport from imaginary time data. If you are a Monte Carlo person, you're familiar with working with your imaginary time data. And when I say transport, the first thing that would come to your mind is, are you doing the analytic continuation? And the answer is no, we're not doing the analytic continuation. But if you believe the essence of what would amount to a successful analytic continuation is already in the imaginary time data, which is what you're trying to do when you do an analytic continuation, we would like to just learn that essence. So we were able to learn superconducting fluctuation using quantum loop topography, and now we're working on learning about learning non-Fermi liquid behavior. This is using data, mining data that was generated by Sam and Karsten. And two different models of fermions interacting with quantum critical fluctuations. And this is a quantum critical point, and you expect a fan to exhibit some non-Fermi liquid behavior. So we're marching through these data points and using machine learning to try to detect, see if we can differentiate non-Fermi liquid behavior from expected Fermi liquid behavior. Currently, this project is being spearheaded by amazing undergrad, Trey Driscoll. We've also worked on looking at out-of-equilibrium states using same kind of machine learning tools. Basically, the idea is we want to target the problems where there are no conventional easy way of doing that knowledge compression and using neural networks as a function modeling tool to give us that regression. Now I want to move on to what I promised, that is supervised machine learning for hypothesis tests on real data, as well as unsupervised machine learning to discover new phenomena in also in real data. So you can find the details of this part of work, this part of the talk, in this paper that actually appeared in publication about 10 days ago. This is a paper that was in making since about a year ago, and we are really excited to be the first group to actually having worked on experimental data from quantum materials. So what were we after? The mysteries of high-TC superconductivity, if you're old enough to have heard about the enigma of high-TC superconductivity. The problem is that with the simple conventional superconductor that we understand with the successful models giving us the confidence that we understand that I mentioned earlier, there was no notion of phase diagram because there is only one axis that you're changing. There is the temperature, you change the temperature, you go from superconductor to Fermi liquid, there's a single point at which the transition occurs. One of the things that the Kupre superconductivity, the discovery of it brought to the forefront was the notion that there can be an extended phase space, not only temperature, there can be the material family. And as you change the hole doping, by changing the chemical composition, you go from some well-known phases, such as antiferromagnetic ordered phase or superconductor, but also you find these poorly labeled phases because we didn't know quite what to make of them. There are multiple phases and they're unidentifiable regions. And what's been happening over last decade or so is the mounting evidence that there seems to be some density wave that is a spontaneous modulation, organization of electrons, and pneumatic order that is spontaneous rotational or Poincare symmetry breaking. And these are the papers, experimental papers, that have been kind of adding on to this notion of local form of order showing up. And this is an X-ray data, which shows that as you cool down from 300 Kelvin to 20 Kelvin, there is this new peak showing up, which indicates that there is a new wave vector that's becoming important that has to do with modulation that's spontaneously unsteadying and modulation of charge. But the problem is that this peak is very broad. When you look at the same phenomena in real space with STM, what you see is that there are this kind of short-range orders with topological defects that are visible. But at the same time, you can clearly see with your eyes some local motifs showing up. What's happening is when you see this kind of pattern and recognize the motif, is that your brain is engaging its superior motif recognition power. The problem is my brain sees the same thing and your brain sees the same thing, but when it comes out in communication, in papers, in conferences, it has to go through the whatever we recognize in our head, have to go through the layers of our bias, layers of our prejudice, and there has not been a principled, objective way to go after these motifs. So that's what we wanted to do. We believe that when there is this kind of experimental data that's been accumulating over literally 15 years, you should be a way to assess from this kind of data set whether we should think of this from the real space strong coupling perspective or K-space weak coupling perspective. There should be a way to look at a collection of these data and find what is common in them. Now, why do we care about real space versus momentum space? Now, this is the process of defining the hypothesis, figuring out what is a problem at stake, and this is where my domain knowledge as a condensed matter physicist enter. My domain knowledge says strong coupling mechanism would be something that has to do with undoped state, which would have antiferromagnetic order, and when you try to dope it, your holes will initially go into in between the copper sites, that's the oxygen site, and that's going to create, if you want those holes to be able to move around, you want to create a domain wall. And such domain wall formation as a way of creating a modulation would mean the location of those domain walls would be commensurate with the lattice separation. The weak coupling mechanism would come from the Fermi surface, which is dictated by the kinetic energy. And you say, okay, I'm going to start with the kinetic energy, which is ignoring any interaction effect. And then I'm going to ask, what is a little bit of interaction that's going to do to destabilize this Fermi surface? And that happens when you have nesting. And if you are going after nesting, because the Fermi surface geometry changes with doping, you expect the nesting wave vector to have no particular relationship with the lattice constant, but to have a particular change that is decreasing with the hole doping. So now I have formed hypotheses that I want to test, and these are hypotheses that have theoretical stake in them. And I want to test these hypotheses in a principled, objective way against the data. What has been a conventional approach? If I say I want to study some modulation phenomena, everybody will say, well, just do Fourier transform. But that's not where we stop, because Fourier transform is a linear transformation. You don't lose any information. So what was complicated in one basis would likely remain complicated in another basis if it's just a basis transformation, unless you found an amazing perfect basis. Now, in this problem, what happens when you do Fourier transform is that you do not get a nice simple form. So then what you do is you compress the Fourier transform down to some arbitrary form of reduced amount of information. You take this data, Fourier transform, and you make a line cut, and what you see is this kind of complicated pattern. The reason why there are these lots of wiggles is not only because the field of view is small, but because there's intrinsic heterogeneity. So So momentum space, which you get by doing the Fourier transform, is just really not a good basis. All this heterogeneity comes from the existence of extremely short-range features, such as topological defects. But our eyes see the motif, and we want to go after the motif. With this traditional approach, earlier in 2006, a group based at Harvard of Subir Sachdev, group based at Stanford of Steve Kibbleson both declared defeat, meaning that they said at the end of their analysis, they had to acknowledge that there was no way to tell apart the hypothesis that they set out to tell apart. It's a really respectable, honest paper where theorists say that I wanted to tell these apart, and I had to conclude that I cannot tell this apart. So we approached this with a new set of tools, and we proposed this three-stage protocol. The first stage is to turn our hypothesis, the meaningful things to tell apart coming from our domain knowledge, into a training set. We have idealized limit in our head that I can draw on a piece of paper. We would diversify that with noise and fluctuations that we include so that we have a diverse training set. And then we'll train a neural network with that training set. And once we have a trained network, we'll give the real experimental data and see what we can learn about the real experimental data. In training set generation, once again, our domain knowledge of kinetic matter physicists enter. As a theorist, we know charge density wave is a complex order parameter. It has amplitude and phase. Therefore, there can be noise in amplitude as well as noise in phase. And noise in phase can be both smooth, gradual fluctuations, as well as vortex-like topological defects. So we include all of this in our training set generation, trusting that our knowledge of charge density wave was giving us guidance on having a simple picture for this training set generation. And these are different categories that we set out to test. This is only category where whose wavelength is commensurate with the lattice constant. This is in unit of lattice constant. And these other categories have different wavelengths such that the wave vectors are all within where we see the intensity when we look at the Fourier transform. Now, we're going to look at the doping dependence. These data sets that we have comprehensively studied were literally the trove of data that's been accumulating over 15 years. We go to the underdope regime, and we look at the real data. Its Fourier transform looks like this, and we look at the outcome of the neural network. And what you recognize is this category two, which has to do with the period four modulation, is outstandingly getting the weight of the neural network's confidence compared to all the other categories. The red and yellow has to do with giving the data in two different orientations. Our training set had unidirectional modulation, so we gave the data set in two different orientations. Now we march up in the doping. So we went up a little bit on the doping axis. We're still seeing the same category to have the dominant weight. Move up again, we're still seeing the dominance of period four. And now when we go past optimal doping, we find that none of the categories are particularly coming out to be dominant. So what we've discovered by looking at the data this way is that there are motifs that are common among all the underdope set of the data. And by the time you reach beyond the optimal doping, there is no meaningful information we can get by trying to compare these different hypotheses. Now we look at the energy dependence. I mentioned that we have these layers of energy, and that makes it really formidable for manual kind of analysis. Now we give the same, we give all the energy dependent layers to the same trained neural network. And this is picking one doping and going up in energy. At low energy, you see still all different categories are kind of neck to neck. But as you go up in energy beyond some threshold value, which correlates with the so-called pseudo-gap energy scale, you see this category two start to become dominant. Moreover, the red and yellow are showing strong disparity.
Four
So these four are coming from, you take this kind of distribution of free momentum, and you sort of look at where you can, we're putting a grid in the momentum space. And when we, this is within, staying within a range where we see the weight, and putting some resolution that seemed meaningfully separate. So we wanted to cover the base over which where there is intensity, but we didn't want to fine tune it so much because clearly we don't have, you know, all that great of momentum resolution. Now this is looking at the energy axis and the output. And category two is clearly picking up in for the one orientation as compared to the other orientation. I don't know why the yellow is not being present here, but this is showing that this is where you see the strong onset of the preference to this period four commensurate motif. So based on this analysis, we've concluded that this data supports between these two hypotheses, that is weak coupling incommensurate density modulation versus strong coupling commensurate motifs, the analysis supported the strong coupling unidirectional lattice commensurate period for charge modulation to be a common feature in all the underdope data set that's looking at many different sets of data sets. Now I want to move on to unsupervised learning of X-ray data. This work was done in collaboration with colleagues in computer science, Killian, and operational research, Andrew, and his student data set and a lot of knowledge about how the data set is obtained came from Jacob Ruff at Cornell High Energy Synchrotron Source. And my students, Jordan and Mike, have been really leading the effort. The goal is to go from this large volume of data, now here we are really talking about large data, to rare, interesting regions that are associated with collective phenomena of electrons that are reflecting the interaction among electrons. So before I move on to X-ray, because the audience is diverse, I want to remind you of what you've learned about diffraction sometime in the past. So when you measure intensity as a function of momentum transfer, this intensity is proportional to amplitude square of the free amplitude of density, the density that the beam that you are diffracting with would couple to. So if we have a density wave with wave vector q, that is modulation of periodicity 2 pi over q, your order parameter, your density profile will look like this. There will be some constant background, and there will be the modulation piece. And this will be the amplitude of modulation. This is the phase of the modulation that's showing the periodicity. The intensity at that q, if you knew that q to look at, would be directly proportional to amplitude square of the order parameter. So all that I've learned as a condensed matter theorist tells me, okay, the order parameter of some spontaneous symmetry breaking, if it is a thermal transition, will show an onset at a particular transition temperature. And the background would not show any kind of special temperature-dependent behavior. So I want to be able to sort out in the collection of intensities obtained at all different momentum points, that was my cube, as a function of temperature and many different temperatures or pressure or the concentration or the composition, I want to sort out something that is reflecting the ordering phenomena that is combating against entropy effect. So I take this data, and I say, okay, I want to look at the intensity as a function of temperature. Why don't I plot them all? This does not look like much, but this is actually a plot of intensities at all these different momentum points as a function of temperature. This is the collection of the entire data set. I said this was hundreds of gigabytes. Why does this not look like much? The reason why this does not look like much is because there is a huge scale variation. Remember, this is a log plot. There is scale, the signal at the scales that are many thousands, many orders of magnitude larger than the intensities down here. This is actually what I will call extreme high intensity, quote unquote, background, because this is only telling me about the lattice constant. And what I'm actually interested in is some collective phenomena. It's not going to show up as the extreme bright Bragg peak, but it's also going to be, so it's going to be somewhere down here, but there's also very low intensity noise that has nothing to do with collective phenomena. So this extreme variation in scale makes analysis of this data challenging. Well, if I don't want to look at the Bragg peak, let's just look at the low intensity scale. You blow up and you see all this mess. So out of this mess, I want to discover the trajectories. This is plotting intensity at different Qs. Different Q, the temperature dependence of intensity at different Qs are represented as different colored curves. So I have plotted all the data, many such cubes in this single plot. And I want to discover which is a Q that's associated with, say, charge density wave, which is a Q that has to do with something interesting, and ignore the rest. Now, this is a lot of information, and it's all mixed up, and it's hard to figure out how we tell this apart. So the manual approach, the current state of art, is some experimentalist, graduate student or postdoc, would take this cube of data, and they would guess what would be a good plane to cut at, because if you have a 2D distribution, that's much easier to inspect by eye. So make a cut and make a slice and look at it. If you don't see anything interesting, make another slice and look at it. You repeat that process of literally lifting one hay strand at a time over the course of months. Now we want to accelerate discoveries and go from the months of inspection by eye to discovering the models that are underneath this trend and thereby clustering and being able to just zoom in onto the interesting part of the data. So this is work that is currently in progress. We've been at this for about a year now. And we at the moment we have worked with a prototype candidate data set coming from this material, titanium diselenide. And we've developed the algorithm that works very satisfactorily on this data set. Where we are right now is now trying to use this algorithm to actually go discover new physics. So we are in contact with many different experimentalists trying to find new data set that have not been looked at, trying to really use this tool for discovery. But already what we were able to do with this data set that forms a good prototype candidate because what's going on is well understood and nevertheless is still relevant today is very exciting, especially given how much we were able to do with this Stone Age tools. So I wanted to tell you about that. So what is a traditional generated model? Traditional here meaning in my domain as a condensed matter theorist. When I show this kind of plot to anybody who has, you know, taken, let's say, undergraduate thermodynamics or statistical mechanics, will say, well, I know what's going on. When you see this data, this is discrete set of data, you've already made a generated model in your head, and you filled. What the generated model allows you to do is to make a prediction for where the data measurement has not happened yet. You filled all the intermediate points, and you've even put a nice kink here, and you've said, oh, well, that's a mean field transition. Well, that's a very successful traditional generated model. When given this kind of data, we would make prediction. And our predictions are, our model is parameterized by what we understand from Ginsburg-Landau theory, which has only two parameters. So what the a successful generative model does for you is to take the data set that you're trying to understand and form the prediction for going forward, take the large volume of data set and compress it into a few hyperparameters that you want to be able to discover. If your data is well captured by the mean field theory, there are only two hyperparameters, R and S, and figuring that out amounts to forming the generative model so that you can make the prediction for the data points that have not been measured yet. But what if there are multiple models expected, as we expect in that data set I was showing you in the X-ray data, because there were trends that must have to do with charge density wave. This is a charge density wave system, and there will be also different types of noise. So we anticipate in general, when you look at this kind of X-ray data sets or different neutron data sets, multiple unknown models. So what do we do if we have multiple unknown models expected? Here, buried in here, we anticipate multiple unknown models. So what Jordan proposed to do, because of this large scale variation of the backgrounds, he proposed, okay, let's first separate out the low intensity background, that's just simply uninteresting. And he plotted the log average, that is temperature average of intensity, and take the log of it and plotted the histogram of those values. And he found for many Qs, this average over temperature was, because the intensity is generally low, the average was generally low, it was falling down low here. That's the raw data. Blue curve is the raw data. And he fit this background with Gaussian back here by minimizing KL divergence. We picked a kind of truncation point, and we decided, okay, all of this is low intensity noise. We're just going to focus on this high intensity part. That's how we separated out the low intensity part and be left with high intensity cues that we are going to inspect. Now there is still extreme high intensity background that has to do with these Bragg points. Because they are associated with the neighborhood of the Bragg points, we separated them out yet again, and now we're left with these points in Q space, much smaller set of Q points, where there is a substantial intensity, but they are not associated with Bragg peak, so it's not directly a reflection of something happening near the lattice constant scale. Now, what we did is using, at this point, is using a long-standing, well-established tool of Gaussian mixture model. So in Gaussian mixture model, what you do is you assume there is multivariate Gaussian distribution underneath your data, which is going to be characterized by its mean and the variance. Multivariate because we are going to try to fit the entire trajectory, that whole temperature dependence, with this Gaussian. So this mu is actually a vector of the length, the number of temperature points we've studied, and this variance will be a matrix. You assume the multivariate Gaussian, so the hyperparameter is the mean and the variance, but we also assume that there is more than one such Gaussian distribution the data is drawing from. So we assume there is a mixture and put a mixing weight. So these mixing weight for different clusters, as well as the mean for the given cluster and the variance for the given cluster, are the hyperparameters that we have to learn. And we learn these hyperparameters by maximizing this log likelihood of, given the assumed hyperparameters, what is the likelihood of the actual measured data coming out to be what it is. That's the conditional probability. And we maximize this log likelihood using expectation maximization. So when we take this approach to this the data set, after having removed both the low intensity noise and high intensity noise, this is our remaining data set that we implemented this clustering on. What we are doing is, for each of these trajectories that are associated with different cues, we're treating different Q points to be independent. In reality, they will not be independent, and to be able to incorporate their correlation between them would be to go a step forward from our current Stone Age to the next level. But for the moment, we are ignoring the correlation among different cues, treating different trajectories as independent trajectories, which are belonging to one of two clusters. So we set the number of clusters to be two. We assume that there will be two clusters, one associated with background, the other associated with charge density wave. And we're trying to discover what is a mean trajectory, because this is a vector, at including all different temperature points. This mean, once we learn it, will give us the trajectory, and the variance will give us the uncertainty of our distribution, our learning, what we've learned doing this unsupervised learning. And once we are given that mean, as a result of having successfully maximized the expectation and arrived at the learned hyperparameters, we can stare at it and look at it as a physicist and apply all our knowledge to it and see whether it makes sense. In other words, this approach allows us to interpret the result of learning. So we employed this approach, and this is what we get. So these are two colors of clustering. The clustering weights, pi of k, were not bimodal, but roughly it came out to be large for one of the clusters and small for the other. So for simplicity, we plotted into two bimodal color. So all these trajectories, remember each trajectory, this is horizontal axis temperature. Each trajectory is associated with a particular cube point in the reciprocal space. This cube, the volume of cube that we were trying to investigate and interrogate. So we found all these trajectories belong to one cluster, and all these trajectories belong to another cluster. And we also learned our mean and the variance. So this is the mean, and this is the variance. And looking at this mean, we recognize, okay, this cluster is background. My algorithm only gave me this clustering and the mean. And to label it as, okay, this is a cluster that's associated with charge density wave with the transition temperature here, and this is a cluster that is just a background, is me applying my knowledge as a kinesimeter theorist. Now we can look at which are the cue points that belonged to this cluster, and say, go back to my experimentalist colleague and say, hey, we looked at your data and we discovered potential charge density wave phenomena at these wave vectors. What do you think? So these are the points that we've identified through clustering. And those actually coincide with the known charge ordering wave vectors of this material. And this whole process, once we have working algorithm, it took us a year to develop the algorithm and all the pre-processing schemes. Now that we have working algorithm, this whole process takes 10 seconds as opposed to many months. So now where we are at is to use this tool to look at other experimental data sets and try to discover, accelerate the discovery of this collective phenomena. And we are looking at materials where there are truly mysteries, such as uranium leaching to silicon 2, which has hidden order transition, and so on. So I think that is it. So I talked about how we're trying to use machine learning tools to embrace and move forward beyond the data-driven challenges that we are facing. And I talked about using supervised machine learning to do the hypothesis test, that is testing, you know, different theoretical ideas in a principled and objective way against the data, trying to see what the data is really saying. And that can give us new insight into the phenomena that's going on in the complex data, allow us to compress this complex data set that I cannot remember all in my head into one word that I can remember. There was period 4 commensurate modulation. Unsupervised machine learning tools, we're working on developing tools and applying it to new data sets. The goal there is to accelerate discovery because the detector technology, the measurement tools have all progressed. It's only the data analysis part that that are remaining in that prehistoric, pre-Stone Age era, and we're trying to accelerate discovery such that the larger volume of data that we can now acquire and store can be actually exhaustively studied rather than getting a partial biased view here and there. So that's the summary, and thank you for your attention. Yeah. So for the STM, in order to do this, the data set that's been collected over 15 years were not collected with this approach in mind. So you know the standardization has issues. So some data sets have larger field of view, some have smaller field of view, and we have to all standardize. With the X-ray, the experimentalists are used to being able to only look at small portion of the data. So when they take data, it's in the detector angle frame. And you have to then transform it over to the QXQIQZ frame. And some groups have the software to transform that and give us in momentum space. But other groups are not used to being able to transfer. So they say, all the experimentalists, everyone I talk to, say, we have large volume of data. So then I say, okay, give me data in the momentum space. And they say, the person who knows how to do this transformation is somewhere else, and it's going to take us 2 months. So I think what's going to happen moving forward is The thing is that experimentalists, by default, because the detector setting is set such way, default is that they take large data, but they are not used to looking at the whole thing. So it's taking some communication and explanation, back and forth to tell them what is it that we can work with. They're not used, they would give us a strip of the momentum space. And I call back and say, no, we want the full Brillouin zone. Actually, I want thousands of Brillouin zone. So I think it's going to change the culture. It's going to change the culture in which how they take the data. Yeah.
I wanted to ask the first speaker yesterday, and then I talked about training on models which have lots of layers over lots and lots of parameters. And you mentioned at the beginning of this talk that many of the tools that you use are actually Stone Age tool,
right? Right.
These are things which don't have to use so many deep layers. For somebody like me who's a master's student, I'm just getting into this field, and I want to learn more about the techniques that are turning out to be more effective for actually extracting information from these giant data sets. What would your recommendation be for the first place?
So I think although I emphasized what could be done with the Stone Age tools, and Giuseppe talked about trying to move beyond the Stone Age. Actually, what we both talked about is that when we try to use these tools that were not developed for the type of data that we're looking at, the work is necessary to choose the right kind of tool and choose, adapt it into the form of the data that we are looking at. For wave functions and quantum states, you're looking at complex numbers, and these data sets, made for pixel and the face, so facial recognition, are not dealing with complex numbers. The data set that we're looking at, for instance, so with the With the Stone Age tools, the shallow network applied to the STM data, we didn't actually start there. I made it sound like I knew how to be efficient. Of course, that's always in retrospect. We actually started with, you know, deeper convolutional neural network, and it had a hell of a time training. It just couldn't train. The problem was convolutional neural networks are designed to make use of translational invariance. That's what you do with the filter moving around. My data set had topological defects. Topological defects are localized in space, but the location is very local, but it affects the entire data set. And these are the kind of things that really challenged training of the convolutional neural network. But with our shallow, you know, some small number of neurons, homemade neural network, we were able to train it. And we were able to understand what was going on. And that's why we stayed with the simpler tool there. With the X-ray data set, we actually set out to use GP mixture model, Gaussian process mixture model, which is a much more sophisticated tool, I would say, in the generative modeling world. Perhaps, you know, it's much more cutting edge. That's what Uber uses, okay? We try to use this GP mixture model. Again, we had difficulty training. And what we realized is that the structure of our data, because our temperature point at which we take the data was all the same for all the database, it's different from looking at a population of human with their, say, health history. We were collaborating with a computer science group who had developed a GP tool for the collection of health data for Gates Foundation. So we were initially going to just use the tool that they have developed. But then it had a lot of difficulty training on our data set because compared to the sort of human health data, what we are looking for turned out to be very rare phenomena. And the tool that we set out to use that was developed to the high level of optimization, you know, speed and whatnot for different type of data just wasn't working well. So although the Gaussian process approach is actually capable of handling the correlation between the momentum, which we ignored in the mixture model, we just couldn't train it. So we then stepped back and said, okay, let's do something simpler, dumber, that we know what is going on and see if we can get somewhere. So now that we've gotten somewhere with our Gaussian mixture model, what didn't work with the GP that's much more advanced, cutting edge, very modern, and what was working in this model gave us new insight on how to find the next level, next stage tool that is best suited for our kind of data. So my experience is that optimizing the match between your method, your tool, and the structure of your data. If the cutting edge tool Facebook is using, Uber is using, is working on a certain type of data, and if you're confident with your knowledge as a physicist, that the structure of your data is very much analogous to their data, go ahead and do that. But if not, perhaps it could be very instructive to start from, you know, simpler, fewer moving parts, Stone Age tools, and ultimately it comes down to the following: the more expressive your model is, the harder it is to train. It's just as simple as that.
Hey, thanks, very interesting. All right, time for maybe two more quick questions.
Thanks. Thank you for your talk, it's very interesting. I am coming with a bit of a different perspective because before going back to school to do my PhD, I worked as a network automation developer. And so from an automation perspective, one thing that I'm seeing here, you know, you mentioned at the beginning that we're starting to automate hypothesis testing using supervised learning and even scientific discovery using unsupervised learning. And I'm just curious, if we're starting to automate even theoretical physics and our interpretation of the physical world, is there any limit to what we should automate, and what do you think about that?
So I don't want to say automate, yeah. but I want to, so this is the perspective that I give. So back in the days when Babbage is, you know, some of you know probably, who had a vision for computer, very first computer. He was talking, this is hypothetical because I read it in a novel about Ada Lovelace. So there's a scene depicted in the novel where Babbage is describing his machine to his colleagues, and his colleagues are all concerned. Why? What Babbage said was that if I invent this machine, we will be able to calculate logarithms. So before computers, how were the logarithms being calculated? Any idea? Anyone? Before the slide rule. This was before the slide rule. People tabulated them, okay? So they were tables of logarithms. But what happened was a library that held the tables of logarithms burned down. This was hundreds of years of work that burned down in one day. So what do? There was a philanthropist who had a vision to build this table. He hired a lot of former hairdressers. Why hairdressers? These hairdressers lost their jobs because of the revolution. These hairdressers were all making wigs for the aristocrats. When all the aristocrats lost their heads, there were no more heads to dress. So all these hairdressers went into a factory, calculating factory, and they were calculators. So what were the concerns of Babbage's friends? They said, these poor hairdressers will once again lose jobs if you invent this machine, right? So, but you know, history moved on and nobody's calculating logarithms using the table. And there, and in this movie of Hidden Figures, there was a scene of the ladies, former calculators, becoming programmers. So my view is that the automation of simple tasks are inevitable. So you want to be ahead of the curve, you want to be the programmer instead of becoming extinguished calculator. Do I think the theoretical physics can be completely replaced by machine? I don't think so. And what I am emphasizing, so what I try to emphasize throughout is, tools, there are different tools, and all these machine learning tools are tools. Automation is kind of a perspective that builds in some philosophical view. The way I look at this, these are tools. And, some of you may love chainsaw, some of you may love, standing mixer. I love standing mixer, I like to bake. But standing mixer is not very useful if you have to cut a hardboard. Different tools have different usage, and having the understanding of the tool so that you can wield it for the right perspective, I think that's our responsibility, and knowing what problem to go after. Hope that answers your question.
Yeah, great, thank you.